Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
So, Matt, tell me about Linda from Honduras.
Well, Linda is a woman that I didn't know very well when I was writing the book, but I knew she was from Honduras. And in chapter three, I have a study that I discuss about an immigration policy called TPS, or Temporary Protected Status. And it applies to immigrants from certain countries, including Honduras. So I didn't think the policy was very exciting at the time. I included the study because I wanted to illustrate a certain statistical technique. It didn't apply to me or anyone I knew, but I decided, let me ask Linda if she has heard about it. And I sort of didn't think that she, that would, but it turns out not only has she heard about the policy, but she had an amazing story about her two nieces. One of them is under TPS, in other words, is able to work legally and is protected from deportation, while the other one isn't.
And so what is the TPS policy? Why does the U.S. government grant it to some people and from some countries at some times and not others?
Well, it's granted in cases where there is a natural disaster or, armed conflict. Basically, it is to so people from those countries don't have to go back in those disasters. But it's granted only for people who come in at certain times, and that is to make sure that only people I suppose it's to make sure that people don't use it as a way of getting in. So the people who are here don't have to go back, but it's not going to allow more people from those countries to come in. So it's not an asylum type of thing. It's to prevent people who are already here from going back.
So you get here and then because you're saying I'm a refugee from some disaster in my home country, then they may grant this status to you if you can sort of demonstrate that that was why you left.
Yeah, exactly. So, I would imagine when they were debating the policy, they didn't want to make it so broad that it would apply to everyone. So it only applies to you if you come in basically before the disaster starts. And that happened with Linda's.
You're not actually a refugee from the disaster. It's more like we don't want to send you back into a disaster.
That's exactly right.
Oh, interesting. Okay, I didn't realize that. So the two nieces.
Yeah, she came before. That was there. I think it was a natural disaster in Honduras. She came before that. The other one came a few months afterwards. And so the one who came in first was protected. The one who came in afterwards was not protected. And it had a big impact. At first, I was asking her about labor market outcomes because that's what the study that I was describing in the book chapter focused on. So things like employment, wages. That study found that people who had TPS had higher wages, higher rates of employment, as you'd expect. And she confirmed that. The niece who has TPS has a full-time salary job with benefits. She works hard, but she's got a good life. The other niece, who doesn't have it, has an extremely difficult life. In terms of employment, she works below minimum wage jobs because she's an illegal, she's an unauthorized immigrant. And so she's, you know, her employers are able to take advantage of that. She has a very hard time finding work. And so, you know, these are some of the stories behind the data in a way. So we can see that, yes, on average, people with, who are unauthorized immigrants have lower wages and so on. But this the personal stories really brings the impacts to life. And she also told me about things about her life other than employment. For example, her personal life and her marriage. One of her her husband was deported after being falsely accused of a crime, and then she was left with to care for her daughter by herself, living in constant fear of being deported herself. And so, you know, this focuses you then on the other aspects of the people in the story here, not just labor market outcomes, but family outcomes. And so it was actually the first time in my career as a researcher that I, you know, really talked to people, you know, from everyday walks of life about the topics that I'm studying. And I think that's probably typical for many economists. You know, we have a very dispassionate way of looking at problems. And in one way, that's good. But on the other hand, if we do something very basic, like ask questions to people who may have firsthand experience with policies, not only can it kind of open our eyes and also our hearts a little bit to the people we're studying, but it can also give us ideas for questions to ask. So, for example, one of the ways I want to extend that research is to look at these other outcomes. So, for example, what about transportation? You know, do people with TPS, are they more likely to own cars and drive to work, whereas people without it, you know, are forced to take public transit, for example? Those are these types of outcomes are things we can easily study. And maybe I wouldn't have thought to study that without talking to Linda.
Right. Yeah. So that's exactly right. I was, and the reason I asked you kind of start with telling us about Linda is just to kind of orient people to, you know, what the, I mean, in a sense, it's one person, but it's also like the bigger picture, right? So what we're going to talk about today is some statistical techniques and a sort of quasi textbook that you've written about them. But I did want people to understand that, like, these are techniques to that we use to understand things that are very important. Like, you know, I mean, in a certain sense, you know, of course, it's not too surprising to understand that being an unauthorized immigrant who does not have a legal right to work results in all sorts of, you know, difficulties and, you know, makes your life really, really hard in America. But also, you know, we have these techniques to quantify exactly how hard and in what ways. And so that's what we're going to be talking about today. So just to back up. So hello, everybody. Welcome to New Books in Economics. This is a podcast channel from the New Books Network. I'm Peter Lawrenson, a professor of economics at the University of San Francisco. My guest today is Professor Matthew Holian, the chair of the economics department at San Jose State University, which I just learned from your book is the oldest public university in California. Is that right?
That's right. I suppose there's a little bit of controversy there because the story is that this first state university was started as a normal school for training teachers, and it was actually founded in San Francisco, but then it moved to San Jose. So I wonder if San Francisco State might also claim the same legacy. Huh. I'm not sure. But anyway, if not the oldest, I think it's the second oldest.
Right. Well, I think University of San Francisco, you know, once you trace back these legacies, I mean, I think University of San Francisco, I think is 150 years old or so. But I think the first, you know, the first thing was not like a professor with a PhD teaching a group of 20-year-old kids. It was probably more like, you know, one Jesuit priest and a couple of students getting a high school style education. I may have the history wrong, but I think
things were quite different in the 1850s.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of things have evolved since then. As a fellow San Franciscan person from one of the many very old universities in the area, I wanted to have you on. So today we're going to be talking about your book, Data and the American Dream: Contemporary Social Controversies and the American Community Survey. So we're recording this podcast just a week or two after David Carr, Josh Angrist, and Hito Imbens were awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics for their work developing and applying techniques for making causal inferences from observational data. And this book provides a practical learning by doing introduction to this sort of family of techniques, showing how they can be applied to important questions in social policy, such as, for instance, the difference in life outcomes that can result from being given legal working status in the United States versus being denied that status. And so this is a textbook, but those of you who aren't professors looking for a new textbook might be starting to tune out at this point, but please don't. Even if you're not the kind of person who would buy this book, my hope is that this podcast, just by talking about these techniques, will be a nice intro to these methods, and maybe also will help to dispel a kind of common misconception that economics is only about things like finance or macroeconomic forecasting, but also can be used to address really important topics that fall into, you know, domains of sociology and politics that everyone cares about, like immigration, entrepreneurship, schooling, childbearing decisions, and also things related to climate change, like energy and transportation usage. So, Matthew, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Peter. I really appreciate it, and especially the chance to that this would reach people who may not normally come across the book, because I did try to write it for a more general readership. I tried to write it at a level that would be accessible for students of all levels, including even high school students, but also for professionals working in the field, people like you, but people from other disciplines as well outside of economics. So, that really, from day one when I started writing the book, framed how I approached it. And it's a tough balancing act because, on the other hand, it's probably most immediately useful for people who are taking classes or working with these techniques. But I hope that it can appeal to others as well.
Yeah, and I think it's nice that you pitched it at an intro level. And obviously, you know, if you're more advanced, you can jump straight into, you know, some of the more technical details, or as you indicate in the book, you could supplement with a textbook that, you know, does more of the theory and things like that more formally. I think your book kind of fits into a little bit of an emerging trend in economics to, you know, get students into the data and the social issues much earlier, you know, rather than starting with like, here's our supply and demand curve and they cross and look, there's this wonderful consumer surplus and producer surplus. And Adam Smith, you know, with his invisible hand has told us that, you know, everything will be great if we're all libertarian and the government doesn't do anything. At least that's kind of the kind of Econ 101 version. That's what some people come away from the Econ 101 version. I think, you know, of course, whenever anyone mentions this on Twitter, everyone says, but that's not what I teach on Econ 101. But, right. But you know, one way or another, that's what people seem to, in the general population, still have the impression that is the foundations of economics. Whereas, you know, as the recent Nobel Prize indicates, what people are doing now is, first of all, on the theory side, of course, the theory is much more developed of, you know, lots of different ways that markets can fail. And it's much more of a, you know, a set of, you know, conditional conclusions or, you know, models that are useful working models for specific situations. You have to figure out which one is the right model, as opposed to there being a right model, which maybe we just need to tweak for some context, but also being much more empirical from the start. So your book is heavily empirical, and a great thing you do is you use a public data set for it, and then you've posted all the code for someone who wants to learn how to like actually do this or, you know, develop it in the class. So why don't you first tell us about the American Community Survey, just like where this data comes from?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would love to get back to the topic of the Nobel Prize too, because mm-hmm. I think it's Josh Angrist in particular is someone who has made empirical research more important to the to economics and especially to intro economics, as you mentioned, but also made a made it make more sense. And so I really struggled with econometrics when I was in graduate school. When I came out, I discovered Josh Angrist's writing, and it came to life for me. And so that was a big inspiration for me in this book. But the American Community Survey is the nation's largest household survey, and it's conducted by the U.S. Census Bureau. And every year it reaches about 3 million people. So they aim to sample 1% of the population every year. And the reason I picked that particular data set is because it's so large. And so here at San Jose State, my university is in Silicon Valley. We're surrounded by tech firms, and big data is the catchphrase of the day. I wanted to give the students exposure to working with large data sets that would push the limits of their, you know, their computer's processing abilities. So that was kind of my first reason for picking that data set. And it's publicly available, as you mentioned. I learned the best place to access it is actually a data center at the University of Minnesota, which goes by the acronym IPIMS. If you go to IPIMS.org, you can very easily download the data, and it's the individual response data. So you'll see how somebody who responds to this survey answered the questions about their gender, race, income, occupation, and so on. And so it's a really fascinating snapshot of the U.S. population. Number one, because it's so representative, you can find a sample of, for example, women from Honduras who came in between 2000 and 2001, and it'll be, you know, several hundred respondents in that subsample. So it's incredibly representative, and that makes it well suited to studying many topics.
So is it, this is now that you mentioned it, I mean, how is it anonymized? It seems like if you know that someone is, you know, I mean, obviously if it's only 1% of the population, then it's not going to include everyone. But if you do find someone in the sample and say, hey, wait, I think I know her, right? Couldn't you identify that person? How do they protect against that?
That's a major concern. Number one, of the Census Bureau, and then number two of IPIMS, because they want the Census Bureau to continue to share the data with it. So you have to acknowledge that you're not going to try to discover anyone's identity. But it's not just that. Of course, they remove all of the identifying information. And you don't know their address. You only know the general area they live in. So like roughly the zip code. It's actually called a public use microdata area. So you don't know that. If somebody makes $100 million a year, then their income is going to be top coded. So, you know, you're not going to be able to identify the super rich that way. I mean, you know, if you think about it, you probably could in some cases, because if you look at their occupation and their area and then their income, maybe you could identify like pro athletes. I don't know. I haven't tried. When I downloaded the data, I said I wouldn't, and I haven't. But actually, there's a raging debate right now about privacy, and the Census Bureau is either considering, or they may have already decided, to take additional steps to preserve the confidentiality of respondents. But the research community, by and large, is not happy about that, because their general, feeling is that, look, no one has ever been identified through this public use data. So all we're doing to take these additional steps is degrading the quality of the data. And again, that discussion is a little bit technical, but to your question, first of all, it's really hard to do. I don't think there's any evidence it's ever been done, but it is a major concern.
Okay, so what kinds of questions does this survey have in it?
Well, it has, first of all, just the standard demographic and socioeconomic questions, like I mentioned, race, gender, income. It asks about your home that you live in. How big is it? How many rooms does it have? Do you own it or rent it? If you sold it today, and if you own it, how much do you think it would sell for? If you rent, how much do you pay in rent? It asks about your energy consumption. The whole survey is about 15 pages long, and I reproduce that in the appendix to the book that you can download for free, the whole appendix and the back matter of the book. And I think that's the best way to get familiar with the survey. If you really want to know all the data or all the variables that are in the data set, take a look at the survey questionnaire. It's 15 pages long. It asks where you were born, when you moved into your current home. From those questions, you can study migration, because you know if somebody was born in a different country, they're an immigrant. If they just moved to their home in the last year, you know where they moved from. So you can study migration, internal migration, where people move from one state to the other state or even across town. Asks about health insurance. A lot of the questions are, when the Census Bureau puts them on, they take into account what do policymakers want to know. And I think the health insurance questions were put on, when the Obamacare debate was ramping up. So there's a lot of questions, and they have to do with, I'd say, the most important aspects of our lives.
And that's great that all the questions are public, because I think it is, as you mentioned in the book, can be, it's important to, or at least can be very valuable to actually read the language of the questions, because sometimes you can sort of look at something as a number in a spreadsheet or in a data set and think you know what it means, but then you actually go and read the question and think about what someone might actually be thinking as they'd answered it, or how they might have misunderstood it or whatever else, then that can lead you in. It can help you understand things more deeply or avoid some kinds of errors.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I always recommend to read those questions. And having focused on this one particular data set in writing the book, also taught me a lot about the data. And I think even researchers in the field, that there are some common misunderstandings out there. For example, what does it mean if there's a missing value, or if the value is listed as NA, you might mm-hmm. say not available. But in fact, that's not the case, because if somebody just doesn't answer a question, say about income, mm-hmm. it turns out what the Census Bureau does is they try to predict what that would have been based on other characteristics that they do know about the people. So that's an imputed value. If you are not comfortable using those basically guesses from the Census Bureau, then there's an additional step you have to take. There's something called a data quality flag. I don't want to get too technical, mm-hmm. but point being, a lot of researchers probably think that an NA value means they didn't answer the question, when in fact it's not the case. Instead, it means that question doesn't apply to someone. It'll be like, how many hours a week do you work? Well, for someone who's unemployed, it would say NA. That's so these sorts of things. And also in the appendix, I have a list of best practices. So thinking about the practitioner audience, what are the top four or five things that they should know? One is about these data quality flags. The other is, about how to deal with inflation, how to deal with something called sample weights to make the data more representative of the population. And then for people who live in group quarters, like a college dorm or prison or something like that, how to know whether we're talking about people in group quarters. So these are some of the technical details that a researcher needs to know to really be able to work effectively with the data, but aren't immediately apparent when you download the data. So I tried to make it simple.
Great. Yeah, I think that's For a lot of things, you want to jump to the fancy statistical technique, but I think understanding the actual data that you have and how it was generated or gathered is a really important first step that it's easy to neglect. All right, so let's jump in and talk about some of the techniques in the book and the topics that you looked at with them. So you mentioned the case of Linda's two nieces, one of whom has, you know, a reasonably good life because she's got this TPS status, whereas the other one is an undocumented worker and faces all the challenges and exploitation that can involve. So I guess so to be devil's advocate, I think a lot of people would say, yeah, I can read the newspapers or walk down the streets and see that it's crappy to be undocumented in America. So what is an economist, you know, why do we need an economist to get a survey of 1% of people in the US to, you know, what more can you get from that?
Right. Certainly, I think the direction of those effects is obvious. And if that was the only point, you know, we wouldn't need to put all these resources into figuring it out. But it's also about the magnitude, you know, exactly how much less do they make? You know, how much more likely are they to be unemployed? And all these other things we can look at, I think it paints a picture of, you know, a really unequal society. In fact, you know, we think of ourselves as, you know, to be kind of free of class in some ways, but it's not the case. You know, we have a whole class of people in this country who live in the shadows, and bringing them out of the shadows, you know, documenting exactly what their situation looks like, I think is important. So yes, the direction, you know, is obvious, but understanding the magnitude, I think, is important. So that would be my response to that. And most things are like that, where, you know, we have a sense that policy works in a certain way. But what's really important is to know how big is the impact. Like another question in the book is about, were California's energy codes that try to make homes more energy efficient, was that a good policy? Because it cost the home builders money to do things like put more insulation in the walls, and, you know, all there's many, many different things that they had to do to comply, you know, in terms of caulking and weather stripping and, you know, windows and things like that. So at the time, it was really expensive. I mean, the policy made it more expensive to build a home. But did it pay off? So it's not enough to just say, yes, the homes use less energy after that policy was passed. We need to know exactly how much energy, how much less did they use, so that we can do the cost-benefit analysis of the policy.
Right. And actually, I do want to come back to that, because that's a nice thing that you cover, which honestly, I don't think I ever covered in any of my training, like, you know, cost benefit analysis. In a certain sense, it's implicit in everything we do as economists. But in terms of the actual research training we get, it's not something where we actually get into the nuts and bolts of it. But, you know, I think that, you know, there's a lot of time in an academic paper, it may just be like, I've shown that there is an effect in this direction, and this is the magnitude. But a lot of the time, the reason, you know, the magnitude matters is because if we're looking at a policy, we want to know, well, if we're, you know, are we spending $1 billion to achieve nothing, or are we achieving a whole lot with it? Or if we're, or maybe we're not spending money, but like you said, we're doing something that, you know, is slowing down housing growth in California, and we have a housing crisis here. So that's no joke. If fewer homes are being built because we're building them nicer, or, you know, more, not just nicer, but more energy efficient, mm-hmm. You know, that's good for the environment, except then all the other people are sleeping on the street or leaving the state or, you know, whatever it is, mm-hmm. something's happening to them. So there are costs of various kinds. So knowing what did we actually achieve with this policy is a really important thing. But let's go back to the case of Linda. So you mentioned, I think one thing actually that maybe your example sets it up to make it look a little bit too easy, or kind of highlights the method that you use, because you mentioned like Linda has two nieces who just like arrived in the US a few months apart, but one of them was, just because of the timing, was eligible for this thing and one of them wasn't, which kind of gets at how you solve this problem. Because, you know, what you don't want to do, right, is to just say, we're going to look at all, you know, undocumented people in the US and compare them to all people who are properly documented, you know, even among immigrants, because there's so many other things about them, right? You know, the person with full documentation maybe has, you know, well, has family members here, or is wealthier, better educated, right? There's so many other things going on. And there may also be unobservable things. But anyway, I'm telling you what you know. So tell me, you already know this. So tell me about, you said in the TPS case, you use that to introduce the method called difference in differences. So tell us about this technique and how it works out in this example.
Yes. So difference in differences and other techniques as well that I discussed, but mostly difference in differences, because there's just so many studies that use it. It's by far the most popular method among studies from economics that use these American Community Survey data. They all rely on the idea of a natural experiment. And a natural experiment is different from a laboratory experiment because there's no experimenter assigning people into a control or treatment group. Instead, natural experiment refers to a situation where some element of the policy environment has the effect of putting people into control and treatment groups, even though that wasn't the design. And so whether we believe the results from these difference in differences studies usually comes down to whether we think whatever was proposed as a natural experiment really was a natural experiment. Okay, so what about TPS? It certainly is possible that after the natural disaster occurred in Honduras, people with less means came to the U.S., and so comparing them to the people who were already here, they may not be identical except for the timing that they came. As you suggested, you know, that there might be differences between these people. So, it's not a perfect experiment. And so maybe we don't believe that Linda's nieces are similar. Maybe we think the one that was here first, she was more ambitious. That's why she got here first. The other one, she only came when she had to leave. It's possible. And even without TPS, their lives would have evolved differently, with one of them being more successful than the other. It's certainly possible. So on that hand, you might say the results that we find are kind of an upper bound on the impact of the policy. On the other hand, there are also statistical ways of controlling for some of those things, for some of the ways that people may differ, you know, for example, in terms of their education level, their age, and that's a technique called, I call it regression control, or the use of control variables. So, you know, I think if you have a pretty compelling natural experiment, and I think TPS comes close, it's not perfect, and you combine that with a well-thought-out control variable strategy, you can get pretty close to uncovering the true causal impact of the policy. But it's important to recognize that there are limitations to it, and to spell them out. And so, you know, generally, I think what that means is acknowledging we may have overstated the impact of the policy. So this may be an upward bound. But on the other hand, when I look at the results, they don't seem outrageously large to me. And so, you know, my feeling is that they're pretty reliable. If anything, you know, you might think the impacts will be a lot larger than they are. So, but that's always the issue, you know, and so when you look at a study that uses difference in differences, on one hand, you ask, is this a compelling natural experiment? And on the other hand, you ask, did the authors make the case for that? And did they do enough, you know, to convince us that it's a good example? So, for example, one thing the authors of that study did was looked at at immigrants from Guatemala. Because Guatemala, there's no TPS. I mean, there's no temporary protection for immigrants from Guatemala. And they found there's no difference among the immigrants from Guatemala who came in at, you know, between 2000, the cutoff, I think, was 2001. I forget at the moment. But before and after the cutoff period, there's no difference. But for Salvadorian immigrants, that's what the study was actually about, who have TPS, there was a difference. So that's the sort of thing an author can do to make the case that their results really do uncover the causal effects.
Great. Okay, so then what were some of the key findings of this study? Things that you, so as you said, you know, maybe not all super surprising, but like, you know, get some estimates of the magnitude of like how big the effects were.
Yeah. So what I was really important for me to do was to replicate some of the studies so that when I would download the data myself and then run the analysis on my computer with my own analysis files, that I would get the same results. And mm-hmm. so sometimes I didn't replicate the entire study and I just focused on a few results. I focused on the employment rates and I think it was about, let me see, about 16%, 16.9%, this is in table 3.1, higher. So that means there's, and this was a sample of women with less education were 16.9% more likely to be unemployed. The other impacts these authors considered, which I don't really discuss in the book, had to do with their wages, and whether they're in the labor force, things along those lines. And I think that the impacts were around the same, you know, size. So around like 10 to 20% worse for people who are undocumented compared to people who, by the way, aren't necessarily documented, but they, well, in one sense, they have the work authorization and they're free from the threat of deportation, but they're not exactly here legally. So anyway, that's the sort of finding that they found. And, you know, and there's room for improving on that study, you know, in terms of, well, first of all, it was published over like six or, you know, it's almost a decade old in one way. So there's just been more data released since mm-hmm. then. So we can use more data. We can use some different techniques that have been kind of more widely known since then and look at different outcomes. So I think I'm getting off track of your question.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, I think maybe my question was a little bit off track in the sense because, I mean, the point of your book is not to, you know, share the results of the specific studies with us as much as to, you know, illustrate how it can be used to, you know, provide answers in this question. So actually, but maybe from here, why don't you talk about like then, you know, in a classroom context, you mentioned like, you know, for yourself, you replicated the study and like, you know, took the same raw data and, you know, figured out how to write the code that would do the exact same analysis and, you know, get to the extent possible, get the exact same numbers at the end. So, so how do you, so what do you have students do to learn from this?
So I've used this this approach in several classes. One is a graduate level class, so many of the students have completed an economics major at the undergraduate level somewhere, and now they're at San Jose State pursuing a master's degree. So for them, I would ask them to find a study and then replicate part of it. And I have a whole section in the book called Finding Studies to Replicate, because picking the right study is the key to doing well on that assignment. Many authors, I shouldn't say many, some authors share their data in code. Some journals require the authors to post their data in code as a condition of publishing their article. So one of the pieces of advice I would give someone who had to replicate a study would be start with a study that you had the code for. But surprisingly, even having the code doesn't always make it a slam dunk to replicate, because a lot of studies aren't even computationally reproducible. What that means is even if you have the code and data from the authors, it can't be run. And if it is run, it doesn't produce the results that they published. So there's actually quite a large movement, or maybe I should say growing movement, in economics and across the social sciences on research transparency. And that's, I think, for me, one of the areas I want to contribute to with this book. So students can learn a lot about doing research by replicating studies, but also the discipline as a whole benefits when studies can be replicated and there's just more focus on, you know, really demanding that that research is replicable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so people can kind of kick the tires and make sure it actually does what it says it can do and isn't, and then also maybe go to the next step and, you know, look at whether different, you know, reasonable specifications, different control variables or cutoff dates or whatever it is, don't just make the whole thing fall apart.
Yeah, exactly. And that we can learn more, we can increase the body of knowledge by building off of work that's already been done. You know, instead of having to go back from square one and reinvent the wheel. So there's not a lot of that in economics. And I think it's going to require a little bit of a culture change, but we're getting there. And you can, you know, see this, for example, in the Journal of Economic Perspectives, there was an article published last summer called Evidence on Research Transparency in Economics by Edward Miguel. And he's one of the economists who has been really pushing this issue. And so, yeah, my hope is that a student, like a graduate student, would be able to pick a study and replicate it. But what about an undergraduate student who enters the class, has never really worked with statistical software before? There, it's more of a challenge because first you have to get them to download the software. And the one that I focus on in the book is R and RStudio, which I use together. I do have some of the files in Stata format, which is the most popular software used by economists. But for an undergraduate student, we have to first have them download the data, I mean, the software, then download the data, then one of the analysis files, which are called R scripts. And then once they have done that, to run it and see if they can get the results, you know, the correct results. So that's a big challenge for a first-time student. So I'm kind of happy if they can do that, you know, install everything and run it, and then understand the code enough so that they can modify it in some way and do something original. That's the goal for a first semester course. And then having done that, the hope would be in the second semester course, they can hit the ground running with their research project that they've already started and do something more original. And so students are really surprised to hear from me that I always begin a research project with old code. I never start with a blank screen. Because for them, it feels like, you know, plagiarism or something like that.
Right.
But the point is that there's no sense in rewriting all of these lines of code that are going to do the same thing. And so it's always about, for me, modifying some pre-existing code. And that is a surprise to students, but I think that's the way to teach them to do research, is to start with something. It doesn't have to be a replication, but, you know, open up a file and then begin to modify it to do what you want to do. And you know, modify it. You might take a lot of modifications, but it's always going to be easier than just starting with a blank screen and typing every single line from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes sense. And then they get a sense of what the finished product would look like, which they might not have time, you know, going from scratch to get to it in a semester on their own.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and it's also important to emphasize that, you know, I call it a replicate and extend approach. It's not going to be able to answer all questions. And so sometimes you have to be a lot more original. But for someone who doesn't even know what the software is, you know, it's so hard to get them to do meaningful research. I think that for them, at least, this starting with a replication is the best way to go. And actually, I'm not alone. I did a Google search for replication and looking at econometrics syllabi. And I'm finding many, many econometrics classes at the PhD level and undergraduate level, less so at the undergraduate level. But more and more people are incorporating replication assignments. It's very common, for example, in PhD programs, I think in the third year, for the students to work on a replication assignment. And I think it's possible to bring that into the undergraduate curriculum as well.
Yeah, I think it's a nice, you know, it's a nice sort of training wheels way to get into the topic. I haven't been deeply involved in like changing the undergrad curriculum, but there is sort of a as we mentioned, like a move towards getting people involved with data earlier on, and not just with the theory, so that, because it does seem like people are really, well, they're intimidated by both. They're intimidated by the theory, especially as it becomes more mathematical, and then also differently intimidated by like the idea of programming, because if they really thought they loved programming, they might have, you know, gone and become a CS major, but instead they're doing something kind of in between with economics. But I think it's easy to scare people off, which is unfortunate because, you know, obviously like there's deep programming and there's stuff that like a real software engineer does, but there's a lot of stuff where it's just, you know, just getting used to being careful with syntax and understanding some logic, and then realizing that it's a matter of, you know, getting practice with a foreign language, can kind of get you there, and getting people over that hump to realize it's a really useful tool is a really important thing that I wish everyone had as an experience as an undergraduate.
Yeah, that's really well said. It is intimidating for them. But hopefully if at the end of the semester they're able to produce some original results that will hopefully give them confidence. But I do find with empirical teaching students to do empirical analysis that, you know, there's so much more to know that they come away feeling like they actually have more questions than they had before, and they don't feel very confident in it. Whereas with theory, you know, the top students can master that in a semester and feel like they really understood the model. But with empirical analysis, I mean, even the people who are in the field doing this are still learning. You know, there's always new and better ways to do the work. But
well, I guess that's the problem. It's like people take that Econ 101 class and they say, aha, I know the answers. And then they spend the rest of their life telling everyone all the answers that they have decided that they know. Whereas in the data class, they're like, oh, it's really hard to figure out what's going on, and I just barely did it. And maybe just because one guy said he did a study or looked at some numbers, I shouldn't just take that on faith. I mean, of course, properly taught, I mean, I do a lot of theory myself, like properly taught, people should be understanding that like the theory is not the answer. It's a way of, you know, framing questions and figuring out what the issues are. But it doesn't seem like that's the way that it comes across or is retained for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah, but one thing I would say, and coming back to this recent Nobel Prize, I thought it was so deserving to give it to those three economists. And for me in particular, Josh Angrist has been a really inspiring figure, because when I was studying econometrics at Ohio State, I really struggled. You know, I had some of the best econometrics professors, at least in terms of, you know, their publications and so on, but I did not know what was going on. And then finally I read Mastering Metrics and thought about this notion of an ideal experiment, and it just simplified things. And for a little while I was kind of thought that I missed out in graduate school, that nobody really explained it to me in such a simple way. But really what the Nobel Prize hit home for me is that actually when I was in graduate school, it wasn't widely known. You know, the way to think about applied research, you know, it's not how it was taught really anywhere. So when I came out, I feel like students coming up nowadays have it a lot easier, in that the whole enterprise of what are we trying to do? And the answer is we're trying to answer a specific causal question. It's just a lot clearer now. And so hopefully that makes econometrics less intimidating. And so I focus more on, for example, the coefficient estimates and making sure those are unbiased, rather than what I think historically or traditionally has been taught in econometrics is, you know, do we have to adjust for heteroscedasticity, or, you know, let's get the standard errors correct, and is it statistically significant? And those things are important, but they're not really interesting, and they don't make the student understand, you know, exactly why are we doing this. It's more of the technical details that were the focus, and not the bigger picture. So I'm not sure if you noticed, but in the book, I actually follow the notation from one of Josh Angrist's books with Stephen Pischke, Mastering Metrics. And the goal is that a person who's using Mastering Metrics in their class can substitute or complement it with my book, and the students won't have to learn two notations. They'll just, you know, have one common notation. But I use the language of ideal experiment and a lot of the same language that he uses. And like I was saying, I found that really helpful in my career. And so hopefully it will also do the same for students who are coming up.
Yeah, that's really useful. I always have to remind myself that as a teacher, like, you know, if I switch note, you know, something that seems like, oh, I'm just, you know, using a P instead of a pi or instead of an R, like even just like changing a letter relative to what I did in the last class, you know, or using a different subscript, people can just completely get thrown off. And it happened to me too. It's not like I'm smarter than them. It's just, you forget, you know, what it was like when you were sitting in that seat, desperately scribbling stuff down that, you know, someone was putting on the board. And like trying to process it, and how little things like that, or like skipping a couple steps of algebra, can throw people off. So that's great that you've got it, you know, unified with that. And I certainly have, you know, yeah. I think the teaching of econometrics, you know, or applied empirical statistics in general has gotten a lot better in recent decades, just because they've sort of realized. Yeah, just gotten. I mean, you know, you'd hope everything gets taught better. Like, you know, probably whenever the first guy was trying to learn Newton's physics, I would imagine, you know, that was a pretty dense text to wade through, and like trying to, you know, you wouldn't send someone back to it now and say, okay, learn physics from the original. You know, people have done it a bunch of times. They've realized, oh, you know what, we can change this notation, make this clearer, and you know, it's just a lot more intuitive and help people get to that endpoint of being able to solve problems with it. Much more efficiently. And I think that's so crucial, considering how much of, you know, our lives in modern society are based on statistical results or conclusions that people have drawn from statistics, you know, correctly or not. So how the more, you know, the more any student in any discipline can, the further they can get in statistics and the more sophisticated they can become as a consumer, I think is really, really crucial, even if they're not going to become an actual, you know, economist or other producer. Mm-hmm. So in the last few minutes, I wanted to ask you also, you covered, I think I mentioned this earlier in the podcast, like, tell me what is cost benefit analysis? Because like, I feel like everyone throws that term around. You know, people who hate economists like to say, oh, economists only care about cost benefit analysis. So they don't care about stuff like the environment or the human heart or like the impact on human beings, which economists kind of bridle against. But because we do think we try to, you know, we can incorporate any kind of cost and benefit, at least in principle, into our analysis. But like, what is there actually to, you know, how do you actually do it in your textbook? And like, what is actually as a discipline or something to be taught?
Yeah, well, you know, like most economists, I didn't really have any formal training in graduate school on cost-benefit analysis, which is, you know, probably shocking for non-economists to hear that. There was one class in the agricultural economics program. I wanted to take it. I never did take it. It wasn't required. Very few students in my economics PhD program took it. But when I started teaching at San Jose State, the chair at the time convinced me to teach it, or kind of inspired me to teach it. And I did, and I found I really liked it. So what it is, if someone says, I did a cost-benefit analysis, to me, that means you did a very specific type of analysis. There's a textbook by Boardman and co-authors that's probably the industry standard textbook. And they have a list of about 9 steps. And I kind of used that, slightly modified it, in the last chapter of my book. And so a cost-benefit analysis is an analysis that follows those steps. And the end of it, the last step, one of the last steps is calculate the net present value of the policy. And so what that means is, so we talk about the benefits of the policy and the costs of the policy, and the policy may have some upfront costs, but then yield benefits over time. So we're going to calculate those over time and calculate the present value of that. So in other words, putting all of the dollars in the same period, was the policy worth it? So when someone says, I did a cost benefit analysis, this we hear this claim a lot in the literature. I always now look, did you calculate net present value? Because if you didn't, then it's probably not really a cost benefit analysis. Sometimes people say cost benefit analysis, they just mean I just talked about costs and benefits, or I analyzed them in some way. But right. But I think people who are teaching this or really working in this field, they mean something very specific by it. And so, you know, when I was writing this book, taking studies, describing studies, trying to do it in a way that would be exciting for a beginning student, I was thinking about my second book. And I'm like, maybe I'll do a book like this, but taking the cost-benefit analyses that have been done and organizing those in a way. And then finally, I realized, you know what, let's just make that one chapter of this book. And so that's basically what I did. So that if you were teaching a course in cost-benefit analysis, you could do the same sort of thing, like replicate and extend. You could ask the students to find a study that does a cost-benefit analysis, repeat the calculations or replicate them, and then extend it in some way, you know, reanalyze it in some way. And I think it's a fascinating way to learn the topic because you engage with real research and you learn not only about the technique, but how to do original research. So I'm finding that there's a lot of room for improvement in the ways that economists do cost-benefit analysis, including just in the language that we use in describing it. So I spend a lot of time on the glossary and making sure that the phrases and words that I use were defined so that somebody would know. And so I try to write the book. I put terms in italics as a signal. Go back and if you don't know what that means, go back and read the definition, because just like learning econometrics, learning cost-benefit analysis comes with the whole language. And you're not going to understand it if you don't know the words and the phrases. So, you know, I think overall the book was, the way I wrote it was inspired by my experience teaching these topics and also struggling to learn them myself. So I tried to write it, you know, with a kind of struggling student or even researcher who's kind of... you know, needs to retool a little bit in mind, could do so easily.
Yeah, well, that's, I think, the best way to do it, right? You don't want to just, sometimes those books written by the, not in the case of Angrist, but like in general, you know, sometimes the book written by the Nobel Prize winner, you know, they're just so smart and maybe sometimes even wedded to showing how smart that they are, that they don't really do a good job of putting themselves in the shoes of the student who's, you know, just starting out in the field. So that can be really challenging. So I think it's great that you, you know, built this book out of your own experience, teaching to real people and, you know, also with reference to your own learning process.
Indeed.
We've gone a little bit. Sorry.
I was just going to just mention one little story along those lines. If in the very first page of the appendix, I talk about physical harm when I was a student and I got frustrated and stabbed myself with a pencil by accident, but just as a signal to the reader that this is hard and it takes patience. And so, so that's in there.
Yeah, I think that is really important. I think it's, we all study from really smart people who make it look easy. And also once they've mastered it, then it is easier for them, you know, it looks easier. And so it's really important to, I try to, I don't know if it's encouraging or not with my entering class of grad students. I always try to tell them that, you know, working on problem sets for me was always like jumping out of an airplane with a parachute strapped on my back, but not really sure if the parachute would open, and, you know, just sort of being kind of falling in terror and confusion. And, you know, generally most of the time the parachute would open and I'd finish the problem set in time, but it would be that, you know, I really wouldn't know. And you kind of, and that part of, you know, part of being good at, I think, a lot of quantitative, especially quantitative skills where there's really like a right and a wrong. And if you're wrong, you can just be wildly wrong. And it seems like you've done nothing, even if you spent a lot of time on it. Then there's that extra level of terror and being good at it involves getting used to that level of terror and just sort of accepting that you're going to want to stab a pencil in your hand from time to time. Yes. And that's, you know, figuring out emotionally how to come to terms with that or whatever is part of it.
Yes. Well said.
Yeah. So, well, thank you so much for your time. This has been a really great talk, and I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Peter, for having me. It's been my pleasure.